just in my brain, I go, okay, let's cut away all the fluff and all the chaff. The basic idea is good guy versus bad guy, good guy versus bad guy. And then how do we build on that by taking away?
Howdy friends, Craig here. Another Insider's Insight as we talk to the designers from Mount Tiki Games. They've got a new card game out, actually combination card and board game called Unperfect Heroes Battle Lines. And it's clever. I think what you're going to enjoy the most and what I enjoyed the most is really getting an insight of how you go from, hey, I've got kind of these characters and these ideas all the way out to we are going to put a fully fledged game out on Kickstarter. We talk about the different design decisions, how you learn to when to make changes and when to stop and actually say we're done. Enjoy.
Playing a tabletop strategy game allows you to unplug and test your skills against friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars delivers useful strategies, discussions, battle reports, and reviews to tabletop games like Malifaux. To get better at the games you already play or discover the games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk Broadcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. There's a new game out on Kickstarter called Unperfect Heroes Battle Lines from Mount Tiki Games. Today, we're talking with two people involved in its design. My guests are Michael Mattson and Bob Maffa. Now, our Malifaux players likely know Michael. He's a very active in the community, and Michael is the creative guy at Mount Tiki Games. He was heavily involved in creating and writing the rules. He's been gaming since the late 90s and working in the industry since 2009. So, Michael, welcome to the Third Floor.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to talking.
Me too, man. So, out of curiosity, what is the biggest thing people don't understand about working in the gaming industries for as long as you have?
I think the biggest thing that people don't understand is just how many different choices there are to make in every aspect of working in the industry, right? Like whether you're making a game or you're selling games or you're promoting stuff, you got to decide, you know, what cream to put where and what choices to make in a game. The game's got a million choices going into game design alone. Yeah. That people just ignore. And we'll get into that a little bit further when we're talking about battle lines. But, you know, it's staggering just how many little choices no one thinks about until it's like laid out in front of you on paper.
So now people listening right now, Mike, are thinking to themselves, I've always wanted to design a game. I've always wanted to get into the gaming industry. They enjoyed playing games. What is something that is... Because at some point, I would assume you were in the same spot, right? Where you're like, man, it would be great to be able to really get involved in this industry. And now that you are, what is something that you didn't realize? Something that's harder than you realize or that kind of sucks about it?
Oh, we've all had the thought to make a game before. Everybody's got that game in the back of their head.
Right.
The thing that really sucks the most is that... that's an interesting question. The thing that I would say probably sucks the most is that you can't have every idea you want in one game.
Oh, okay.
At some points when you're sitting with a game design, like you might have a mechanic that you're just in love with and you want to make it work somehow, and it just doesn't work for whatever you're trying to make it work, and you got to shelve it for, you know, I never throw away an idea. I'll never just say outright it's not good, but I have a folder in my computer that's just ideas I've had that don't work for this project that might work on the next one or the next one or the next one or whatever.
Yeah, I would imagine it would be very hard. I mean, and this is a cliche, but I'm going to use it anyway. Like, they're your kids, right? And you love each one of them.
Yeah.
And you want them all involved in learning to say, you know what, this is not going to work. And that's got to be difficult to trim.
Oh, absolutely it is. That, and also you get I get self-conscious about accidentally mimicking other games with certain things. And so you've got to realize a couple of things when you go into making games and stuff, that, you know, there's no original ideas, that everybody's done something before. It's making what you want to make to the best of your abilities that someone will want to play.
Yeah, that's tough. That's tough. Now, my second guest is Bob, also known as Aloha Bob, and he's kind of the man behind Mount Tiki Games. Now, his love of games brought him from being just a graphic designer into actually producing and creating games. So, Bob, welcome to the Third Floor.
Hey, how you doing? I appreciate you having me.
So your path is a little bit interesting, Bob. So kind of give me a little bit of a history. Before you were involved at all in the gaming industry, what were you doing and what brought you to where you are now?
This actually started a long time ago. Most recently, I have been a photographer and graphic design. That is what I have done professionally for the last 15 or 20 years. I've had several photo studios, design studios, and constantly doing design work of some sort. But what kind of started this whole process was the fact that we had created this idea, my friends and I, 25 years ago, about all these different characters. And we came up with this this family of characters. And during the time that we were doing this, and we can talk about this kind of stuff later, but during this time that we were working with these different characters, we were creating lots and lots of fiction. And we were writing stories. We were writing. We had ideas for screenplays. We had we had done a web TV show. We had done newsletters and magazines. And there was a after about 7 or 8 years of creating this magazine, we finally culminated with this final issue where we said, you know what? Let's just dump everything we have, every idea that we have had in the past or wanted to do. Let's just put it all in this big final issue, and we came up with a magazine that was like 140 pages long.
Wow.
Previously, everything was between 4 and maybe 20 pages.
Sure.
So we just said, let's throw every single piece of crap in here we can find. Well, one of the things that we did in this magazine was we created an article called Failed Waple Ventures. Waple is the name of the family, the Waple family. But we had a page that was called Failed Waple Ventures. And on this, it was like a 1 or 2 page spread where we had all these things listed of things that we had started at one point but never finished.
Okay.
And every single one of these was a thing that we really did start. We didn't really pad this at all. And one of them was a video game and an RPG game. There was actually an RPG that we had written a storyboard for in this magazine, the issue. Well, about 2 or 3 years ago, I was looking through this magazine just for old time's sake, and I came across that Failed Waple Ventures article. I said, man, you know, we had so many good ideas here. And this about 3 years ago, my wife, son, and I started playing board games, and we thought, you know what, we have so many ideas and so many things we could do. Why don't we see if we can make a board game based on this family of, you know, because we have all these ideas, why not try to see if we can do something? And we started creating something that was going to be more of one of those, the board game versions of Dungeons and Dragons, more of like the Castle Ravenloft type of a game.
Right. Dungeon crawler type thing. Yeah.
And then, we started doing that, you know, on my own, and then yada, yada, yada. I ran into Michael, and things kind of took a big change, which we can also talk about.
So I'd be curious, Bob, how did you end up finding Michael? How did Michael find you?
That is an interesting story. That's exactly where I just left off.
It is, yeah.
Well, in the original game that we were going to create, it was going to be I wanted to do something with dice because, you know, everyone loves playing with dice.
Yep.
And my son was just getting into Dungeons and Dragons, and I wanted to create a game that had miniatures. Well, I had these I had found an artist that I love that it's a comedy game. Everything that is based on this game is all comedy based. But I found a great guy that was creating these fantastic images that were he lives in Turkey, I believe, but he was able to get the humor and everything that we were doing just perfectly. Well, I took these images from him that he got basically inspiration from me and these real life people that play these real characters. Mm-hmm. And then I took those things and I found some people online that would be able to create 3D figures from my conceptual drawings and his cartoons.
Sure.
Well, then I went through and I had a 3D printer at the time. I printed these characters in 3D and say, you know, these are what the, you know, figures are going to look like. Well, I went into a couple local game stores and I talked to one of the guys there saying, do you have anyone there that could paint these so they look really, really good? Because, you know, I was putting the cart way before the horse here. And but I said, you know, because I've been in promotion since, you know, forever, you know, in the marketing side of it. And I said, you know, when I have this game, I want to make sure that these figures look really, really, really good so I can use them for my promotional materials. Yep. And one of the guys there said, oh, I know the perfect guy. You need to talk to Michael. And he and I sat down and we talked for about 20 or 30 minutes that first day. And he told me about all the stuff that he does with games, about the rule, especially with the rules and mechanics and all that stuff. And a lot of that, those things I had in my head of what I wanted to do. But then when I started talking to him, I realized, you know, he is going to know a lot more than I could ever possibly know. And what was really great was that, you know, I had these big ideas, and he's really been able to go through and noodle everything and really figure out, like, this is going to work, this isn't going to work. I'll throw out a really stupid idea, and he'll say, okay, well, I'm not going to shoot you down, but here are all the different things that you're going to have to consider.
Right.
And, yeah, so that's how it was. I was looking for a painter, and I found a guy who's like a genius when it comes to numbers and mechanics.
So there's two things there. One is, for those of you listening, you know, being a good painter gets you work. It may not be painting work, but it gets you work. So that's good.
It gets you something.
That's right. But the second part of that, Bob, is a little bit interesting what you're talking about. You know, you walked into this with really so much of it fully formed, right? Because, I mean, these are characters that you have built and fallen in love with for decades now. Mm-hmm. You'd already started saying, you know, conceptually, this is kind of what I want the game to look like, feel like. I have some ideas, you know. How hard was it to run into somebody who, which I appreciate you acknowledge, you know, knew more about it than you did, right? But,
oh, yeah,
but
without a doubt.
How hard was it to run into somebody who said, you know what? I realize this has been your baby for 20 some odd years, but I'm thinking let's take a right turn and let's try this. Was that tough for you to kind of emotionally detach from some of this stuff?
Well, yeah, for about 3 months, I kept putting bombs in his mailbox and putting poop under his, you do have to, I think, have an ego that is not too overblown. I know there's a lot of people out there who are going to say, this is my idea. This is the way it's going to be. But what's good about it, at least the way that we work, is that for one thing, he gets the whole idea about this whole story. The very basic version of this whole thing, just because the humor behind it and the story behind it is what really kind of sets this whole thing up. We had created this basically a family that was based on the worst wrestler in history, Gunther von Wappel. And he was horrible, but he spawned lots of different kids. And we were, at the time, this is back in the mid-90s, independent wrestling shows were very big.
Sure.
We created these characters. I played Biff Wappel, who was Gunther's oldest son, and he was a masked wrestler. And then there were also, Biff had several brothers, and they were also wrestlers, but none of them were good at all. One of them hated wrestling and wanted to be a boxer. He felt like he had to do it, but he quit. Another one of them died. I mean, it's just all these different things. But what happened with all these things is that I said, I'm going to just start writing a little newsletter. All of our friends are going to sit down. We're going to watch WrestleMania tonight on pay-per-view. I'm going to write a little newsletter. I'm going to make a little prediction sheet that said, you know, we can guess who's going to win. But then I'd write these little fake stories about these characters. Well, then other friends said, hey, I want to be a character. I want to do this. And one of the guys decided, you know, he'll be a great manager. He'll be Biff's manager or the brother's manager. Then another one said, I want to do something too. So we ended up with a whole gaggle of people. One of them, we had a chef. We have a mad scientist. You know, it's a wrestling family with a mad scientist and a narrator. You know, his job was to narrate the things we did. A trainer, you know, all these different things. And it just kept expanding and expanding. Well, during the 90s, independent wrestling was big. And you'd go to a gymnasium or a warehouse somewhere, and there'd
especially in the South.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And that's where we were in Atlanta, and that's where WCW was.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of stuff around here. And we As a matter of fact, Cactus Jack, the wrestler Cactus Jack, we actually interviewed him for his very last, right before he went into the WWF at the time, WWE now. But the day before he started the WWE, we actually interviewed him, and that's in one of our magazines.
Nice.
And but anyway, we went to all these little local indie promotions, and we would start writing these articles about what they're doing. And the next week they would come over, we would start handing out these little newsletters. And we'd also, though, include our fake, fictional, horrible wrestlers. Now, people, we didn't, at this time, we didn't really say they were horrible unless you read the magazine.
Sure.
But we would go up to somebody and we'd, you know, we'd say, hey, did you hear that the Waple Boys are going to be here in, you know, in a few months? I said, really? No, I've heard of them, but man, they're really coming? And, no, you didn't really hear, but we just made this up. You know,
yeah.
No idea, but people were thinking, you know, this is all true stuff. So that fed us, you know, thinking, you know, maybe we can really do more with this. And it just kind of grew and grew from there.
What's funny about that for me, Bob, is that, you know, so many people listening right now, I mean, me being me included, I mean, you know, when I was in the 80s and 90s, I had all kinds of crazy ideas, all kinds of characters that I'd created and stuff that I've done, whether it be through RPGs or just me and my buddies, you know, hanging out by the creek and talking about stuff. It's really neat that you have, you know, not only did you hold on to that stuff, but you developed it over time. And it's also neat the fact that you had, because you had published it, you'd left yourself a relic, right? That you had gone back and discovered, which I think is really interesting, where the past Bob wrote a love letter to the current Bob and said, hey, don't forget about this game. And Bob, you talk about, you know, everything that we've talked about so far about these characters is it in a wrestling thing, but the game is not a wrestling game. So can we talk a little bit, like, thematically, what is the game about?
Well, yeah, you're right. It is not at all a wrestling game. And that's one of the things that we really had to try to get people get out of people's minds, was that it's not a wrestling game, but the main character is a wrestler.
Right.
Well, the game actually really changed a lot during the course of everything. When I first talked to Michael, as he'll remember, and like I mentioned, it was going to be more of a Dungeons and Dragons thing where you're exploring. There were going to be roaming PCs, NPCs. You're going to be exploring different places, and you're these unperfect, quote unquote, heroes who think that they have these special abilities, but they really don't. They don't really know better, but they are trying to help people out.
Right.
And when I first came to Michael, you know, he actually got the whole thing, and he said, "This is hilarious. I love the idea. And we can do this and this and this and this," and it just really clicked. Well, what happened was, after he and I were working a lot on these rules, and you had asked about ego, and or I mentioned ego. Yeah. The good thing is that he did not really try to step on any of that I had, and I didn't really have to really quell any of the things that I wanted to do based on the idea part, because it all worked. What I really had to do was listen to his advice and realize mechanically these are the things that we're going to have to scale back, or, you know, we can't use this, we can't do that.
Yep.
And but originally it was going to be a, like I said, the RPG game. Well, not many people, you know, we had a fan base of maybe 7 people, and, you know, 12 of those 7 were us, the real people.
Right.
And, well, the you know, and I said, okay, if we do this game that how I want to do it, we're going to have to sell it to, you know, for like $100. And
it was a big game.
Yeah. And no one was going to pay $100 on something that was, it was not even in a genre that anyone was used to. If we made the same kind of a game using fantasy figures and, or like vampires and dwarves and all that stuff, it would probably do it. But, you know, a waitress instead of a paladin, you know, people weren't going to do that. So,
no, and I can tell you, as somebody who follows Kickstarter and board games on Kickstarter all the time, Bob, I have seen so many failed games come through where God bless the people that are behind it. They have, you know, they have big dreams, and they've spent a decent amount of cash to get the renders done on the minis and so on and so forth, but they didn't do their homework, and they took too big of a leap. So that's good advice, Bob, for you to say, you know what? maybe this isn't what we we're supposed to do. So where did it end up going? So if it's not about wrestling, what's the game about?
Well, we basically said, you know, how can we take these same kind of concepts, same characters, whittle down all the extra expenses and make it into something fun, fast, and inexpensive, something that's affordable for people to buy that may say, you know what, this is actually fun. It's a funny universe. And then once they start playing it, maybe then we can look back and do the full-fledged RPG in the future. So that's what we said. So let's just pair it back. And what we came along with was, all right, we think these people have powers. Well, how do they get these powers? And it is called Unperfect Heroes Battle Lines. And the tagline is that you are battling to the front of a line.
Yeah, let me step in here. We took the original mechanics from the big board game and we whittled them down. We thought, okay, is there a way we can make this a quick skirmishy kind of interaction? And so we thought of Battle Lines. What Battle Lines is it's a game where the Waples have discovered their magic superpower of being able to cut in line. And so they're trying to use that to the best of their abilities to get to the front of very popular lines, which you don't have to provide, but we provide for you, that are things like the porta potty line at the chili cook-off, the all-you-can-eat buffet line, the escaping from a space station because it's about to explode, anything you can shove and get your way out of. But we took the mechanics and whatnot from the original big game, and we whittled them down, and we cut them down, and we cut them down, and we cut them down until we had something quick and playable to put on a board as is.
So I watched your guys' intro video and I've been reading up a little bit on it. And I got to tell you, it's very rare that I come across something that seems anything close to original and relatable. And, you know, and Michael, I'm going to build off what you said, but we all know what it's like to stand in a long line, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I thought it was really, I mean, and I know nothing about these characters yet, but I thought it was very interesting to take something that we've all done before, which is standing in a long queue and making it a game. And the fact that when you also boil down so many game mechanics, really, that's what so many games are, is getting to the front of a line. And I thought it was very interesting that you guys literally took it as a actual line into, you know, the all-you-can-eat buffet. So, Michael, let's talk a little bit now off a theme and talk more mechanics. So, stylistically, what kind of game is this? We know it's not a zombie side type game. So what kind of game is it?
So the basic idea is that this is a gotcha style game. It's a quick to play little, I've got a thing and then your opponent's going to respond with a thing and then I'm going to respond with a thing until we've done the set amount of things the game will allow, which is in the context of this game, recruiting people in the line to help you cut in front of the line or to help you beat up the guy in front of you or to bribe them or to even have yourself chicken out to then be able to sneak past and, you know what I mean?
Right.
The idea is it's a gotcha game combining both board games and card gaming elements for a more controlled variance than you would have with your average dice game.
So let's talk about like mechanically. So we have cards, right? There's cards involved and it's not just cards that tell you the rules. It's cards that you actually play. And
that's correct.
What else is involved? Is there dice? Is there a board?
There is actually no dice, okay. As you see with the tagline for the first first core box, which is no dice. There's a board. You've got standees.
Well, that funny thing is that originally it did involve dice, and we were getting to the point where, God, you know, no one's able to do anything because we had all these complicated combos we were trying to do, and we said, you know what, let's take the dice out, let's do a card based, and then, you know, Michael had to kind of go through and reconfigure everything to figure out how we're going to go from dice to cards. So yeah, ironically, the first the set of cards that come with the game is called No Dice.
And so yeah, we've got the board itself, which is a line, which instead of like a normal board where you've got squares to go in a bunch of different areas, just straightforward, you're going to the front of a line.
Right.
And then you've got standees representing your character and all the opponent's characters. Then you've got the deck of cards, which are representing other people in the line, not you.
Got it.
And so there's you, who is you in the line, which is a person in the deck. But then everybody else is somebody that you are recruiting basically to help you go against your opponent. You've got cutter cards, which are the heroes that you play during your own turn to help you cut past the line. You've got target cards, which are the opponents playing to stop you, to, you know, try and shove you backwards in line. And then you've got the random crap cards, which is just any sort of weird stuff that can happen along the way to mitigate one way or the other the statistics that you use.
So we're going to dig a little bit deeper into some of the gameplay, Michael. But before we do, I'd like to get an idea of context. So a lot of the listeners have played a lot of games. Is there anything that that they might go, yeah, it's kind of like this, it's kind of like that? What are some things that might be familiar about Battle Lines?
So right off the bat, I have to give a big shout out to games like Apples to Apples just for the humor aspect. Just putting it aside, this is a game we tried to be funny with. That being said, it's very similar to games like there's Talisman aspects, there's Kings of Tokyo aspects where you're combining board and card to do things that I mentioned variants a little bit ago. The card aspect is there to be a more controlled variance than just dice,
right?
To give you a more interactive experience, but still have that aspect of chance. It also draws a lot of inspiration from classic board games, Chutes and Ladders, Sorry, any sort of game where there's you're getting
game
from one
life,
point to
stuff
one
like
point.
That. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Because a lot of the classic games from the, you know, 70s and 80s are games that can all be boiled down to I have to get from point A to point B and stuff can happen along the way.
Yep.
And so you basically modernize that and put it into a nice compact form.
And it also sounds like you did some mitigation on the randomness, right? So you were struggling with the dice aspect and the fact that Bob mentioned, you know, it was preventing things from happening, which is fun. And bringing in the cards still allowed a random number generator, but allowed a little bit more control. Bob, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, one of the things that you forgot that it takes a lot of from is actually poker. Something that we've heard from a lot of people that it really is surprisingly strategic. It's not, you know, a lot of games, you basically have two cards and you would say, okay, like if you're playing war, let's say I have a 9. Oh, you have a 5. Okay. I win the end of turn. Well, we actually have a lot of strategy built into this seemingly very basic game because, we have, you know, it's you're not just saying, okay, I attack with, this is my attack. This is your offense. I win. There's actually something where if you attack with somebody using, like, let's say an attack, like you're going to fight. Well, then I would then be able, if I won that fight, I would then be able to move my character forward a certain number of spaces that's listed on the cutter card. However, I could say, you know what? I'm going to bribe. And I would actually use a second set of stats, my bribe score versus the player's bribe score. And if I won that, I would move forward the number on the targets deck. So that right there gives you two different options of, okay, I may say, well, I move 5 if I win in a fight, but I only move 2 if I win a bribe. And then another option is, well, you know, I'm just going to chicken out. I'm just going to procrastinate and I'm going to have someone else just cut in front of the target. And if he played one card, he actually moves back one space. If he played two cards, he moves back two spaces. So you really, really do have to think about what you're going to do in this game. It is really more than just, you know, here's my score, move forward.
It sounds like we've got some really nice key decision points, which is good. And it also sounds like about multiple paths. So guys, what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to focus more a little bit on the gameplay. So we're going to get a little bit more of the nitty gritty. For those of you hardcore gamers that are listening right here, we're going to kind of get a feel of how this game plays out. So we'll be right back.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So I know a lot of the gamers that are listening right now are really anxious because we've kind of teased it a little bit and talked a little bit about it. So Michael, what I want to do is talk a little bit. Let's start basic and we'll build off from there. So from a gameplay perspective, how many people can play the game?
It's meant for two and up, ideally around 5 to 6 people at most. But you can play as many people as you've got cards. And the more people who have the game, you can all shuffle your decks together. And there's all in the rules to be able to play as many as you want. But two and up is.
So what's the sweet spots? Because every game has one, right? So every game has, well, you know, if I had two more players, it's a little bit of a better game, or with one less player. So in your mind, is there a sweet spot?
I think the sweet spot's 4 people. In testing, that tended to be 4 to 6 people was the everybody's doing something constantly, and we're all having a laugh, and there's jokes going around, and it gets meant to be a social game, get together with the buddies, grab a drink, and play a quick board game.
Gotcha. And obviously, and we've talked about it because thematically it fits perfectly. The object of the game is to get to the head of the line, right? To get to the front Correct. Of the queue. How long does a 4-player game usually take?
A 4-player game, if everybody knows what they're doing and everybody's played a couple of times, you're looking to play 30 to 40 minutes tops.
Oh, that's nice. Okay.
It's so, a nice quick game. You're only moving, each board's only got about 15 to 16 spaces, and you're moving hopefully 2 to 3 to 4 per turn. So, you know, on an ideal game, you're done in 5 or 6 turns. You can get through everybody 40 minutes.
Yeah, that's nice. What I love about that game time, and it's something I've become more sensitive to, is my available time for gaming gets smaller and smaller.
Oh, I feel that.
It's really nice to be able to either, A, have what I always used to call on my game nights my opener game, which is everybody's kind of shuffling in. Here, let's do a quick game of this. Then we'll go play the 2-hour game, the 3-hour game.
Yeah.
Or to have a game that we can say, you know, we're going to play this all night. We're going to get 4, 5, 6 of these games in a couple hours. And that's nice.
I wanted to say that what's funny is you can tell the difference between Michael and you being gamers, whereas me, who is a very, very casual gamer, when he said 40 minutes and you're saying, oh, that's a great time, I'm thinking, oh, my God, 40 minutes. I wanted to get done in like 10 minutes. And that's what we originally wanted to do was make something where, you know, if you are playing with two people, you can literally be done in 5 to 6 minutes.
Sure.
You know, if you get the right things. When you have more people, what happens is you stand on people's, basically when you get in their spot, you have to push everyone behind. Because like when you get in front of a line, if someone gets in front, everyone else has to move back a space.
Yeah, you can't stand in the same place.
And when you have a lot of people, that's what really takes a lot of the time, is that you keep getting and stepping on people's spaces and pushing everyone back. It's almost like a little caterpillar movement. But with 2 or 3 people, though, it can go a lot faster.
Right. And when we get into talking about design, which we'll do in another segment, you know, that's a tough balance too, as you're going through that process, because what you're talking about, Bob, is extremely attractive, which is a fast paced game that only takes 5, 10, 15 minutes to play. What you always lose in that scenario is you lose any type of depth, right? So if it's a completely random game, yeah, I mean, we can make the game as short or as long as we want. We're all just throwing dice, and whoever, you know, happened to get lucky that one time is going to be fine off. But if there's actual player agency where the players are making meaningful decisions, that's going to add to the game time and ultimately, for me at least, make it a better game. One of my favorite games that I love to play is a game called Shutbox, which has no strategy whatsoever. You throw dice and you flip down a little thing and it's fun, right? But I don't look forward to playing the game. It's just something I'll do. But for a game that I look forward to, that I think about, I'm going to want that, you know, that level of agency. So, Mike, we talked a little bit about, you know, the 3 different fight stats and the fact that there's kind of 3 different ways to engage with the other players and the other cards that are coming at you on there. There's one just simple win condition. I'd like to get a better understanding, though, of kind of path to the victory, right? So is there only one way to win this game, or can you come at this game a couple different ways and still potentially win it?
just like the classic board games that we tried to initially draw our inspiration off of, there is one way to win the game: get to the end of the line.
Right.
There's no lose condition. There's no other than not getting to the end of the line. There's not like the deck ran out of cards, or you rolled snake eyes five turns in a row, or Abraham Lincoln's ghost came back and told you that going to the skeleton army. There's nothing, you know, outrageously that's going to make you lose, except for not getting to the end of the line.
Right.
And so on that thought, though, there is, even though it is one simple objective, we tried to put as much interesting ways to walk that path as possible. Because each of the characters that you play in the game have got different things they do. So each of your turns, even though you are playing, you know, cutters versus targets, and then playing random crap on top of them, they're all doing different things, and certain of them pair together in other ways, and draw off each other's strengths. And there's, I mean that in an actual mechanical sense, in that if you play certain ones together, they get more abilities, or they get more power.
So there's combos.
Yeah, there's combos and cards that work together, and the random crap is also a pretty big aspect. I know I'm saying that. It's actually, the cards are called random crap cards. I'm not being derogatory towards the card.
So I'd be curious, Bob, you know, Michael having the actual mechanics background and the game design background, you coming at it from really, you know, it's your idea, but you're also, you know, your classic casual gamer, somebody who's relatively new to gaming, who's played a couple games. What did you find the game approachable? Yeah, as far as its final form, or did you find it intimidating? Because a lot of times we can put together a game that gamers, quote unquote, capital G gamers will like, but it's not approachable. So what have you found, Bob, as far as people that maybe not be gamers?
Well, it's actually funny that you say that, because you know, I had mentioned that I was a marketer and a graphic designer for a long time. And a lot of times I came up to a client that would say, you know, a person's got to be an idiot not to know what we do. And I say, I look at your website, I don't have a clue what you do.
Yeah.
I said, the reason is because you made the product, you know what it is. I don't. And same with Michael, you know, Michael he knows all the stuff about games, whereas I, like I said, am relatively new. Well, that, it really becomes a great pair off, because he'll look at something and he'll say, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I'll look at him like with these things in my eyes saying, I have no idea what you're talking about. And then we'll come into some kind of a compromise, and I'll say, oh, okay, that makes sense. Like, one of the things is originally after we got rid of the dice, we went to a numbering system with the combat, and we were going to have combat ranging from 1 to 10. And then I was looking at it and thinking, okay, let's say that someone puts down a 7, a 9, and a 4 on the for the attack, and then they put down a 2 and a 6, and I said, that's a lot of math right there. You know, you know, here I am thinking, you know, okay, you have to add all these numbers and it comes up to 13. Jeez. And he's looking at think, what are you talking about? Math is good. Everyone loves, you know, people can do these with no problem.
Sure.
Numbers are, so we come at it from a totally different way. And one way that we actually compromised on that is said, well, what if we go ahead and take that 10 and move it down to 5? Comes up with the same thing, just easier to add. And
right.
It's, So my experience coming from a casual thing based on and paired that with his, it actually makes a good combo, because if he'll come up with something that I think is just, you know, I said, OK, this game is supposed to be someone for casual. I think it's a little too much. We need to dumb it down for someone like me. But then, you know, there are other games that we have in the process that are going to be
much more my style.
Yeah, they're
right.
Yeah, like there are several games that we have. Like I said, this is the intro game, and eventually we're going to have that larger D&D version. That's going to be a lot more statistically complicated. Yeah,
yeah. Well, intricate, right? Intricate.
Yeah.
No, I definitely get what you're saying. So, Michael, in your mind, you know, one of the big things is. One of the big things for me is key decision points, right? It's part of the reason that I love Malifaux. It's part of the reason you love Malifaux. Talk to me about what you consider the key decision points in Battle Lines.
So in Battle Lines, your key decision points are how you're going to sculpt your hand of cards, because you do have a set hand of cards that you are playing from and replenishing every turn to get new options. And your decision points are how you're going to use each of those cards, because each of those cards by themselves in a vanilla sense can be used one of three ways: attacking, bribing, or running away. But then in combination with each other. And so the main decisions you're trying to make are, what cards will I be keeping? The sculpting hand, like we talk in Malifaux, where you've got, I'll discard the Black Joker at the beginning of the turn, so I have to deal with it for the rest of the turn, or I'll hang on to it for the whole game, like I'm prone to do. In this game, I might go, ooh, I've got a rocket launcher, which is one of our random crap cards. I got to save that until I really need to win a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm, making that decision to keep it in hand. And then I've got, there's not much left to true random chance, but there's, not as many decisions to make as I would like in an ideal game for me. But then again, as Bob pointed out, and it's a really useful tool for people designing games, is to have a Bob. Yeah. To go, I have this really cool idea that I want to do. Do you understand what I'm talking about? Nope. All right. We're going to figure it out until you do.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. So, guys, what we're going to do, we're going to take another break. When we get back from this break, I want to get more into the design process, because it's something that I very, whenever I have designers on the show, I really like to understand what happens behind the curtain and what that process looks like. So we'll be right back. Howdy friends, Greg here. Nothing makes Malifaux easier than having the right tools. Here at the Third Floor, we love all the licensed Malifaux goodies from Custom Meeple. Not only are they helping support this podcast, they sell custom-made weird licensed tokens and terrain. They sell it all. Crew boxes, terrain, markers, tokens, and even a 3x3 full Malifaux board. Custom Meeple sells a complete M3E token set covering every marker and token you need to play. Custom Meeple are the source for the official accessories for Malifaux. Everything is designed by hand and authorized by Weird Games. Check them out at CustomMeeple.com. That's with one M. Or follow the link in the show notes. Up your Malifaux game and be sure to tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. If you use the promo code ThirdFloorFriend, all one word, ThirdFloorFriend, you'll get a 5% discount and help support the podcast. It's valid on everything except retail products and playmats. So the main reason I like to have designers on the show is I personally am very fascinated by that process. I have played a ton of games, and I've played the simplest of board games and card games to some of the more intricate games out there that can take days to play. And when you play a game and you play a lot of games, you get an appreciation for the final product. But being in production in a whole nother world and not gaming, I also know that it starts in one place, and the final product is a long, arduous process of a lot of adding and cutting and tough decisions. And I like to understand that. And Michael, it sounds like you had a pretty interesting scenario here. You had somebody approach you with Aloha Bob, and Bob says, look, these are characters that I've been married to for decades. These are things that I've been developing, printing magazines about, for crying out loud, for a long time. And he also had kind of a large concept of that dungeon crawler with the miniatures and everything, which is initially how you got connected as a painter. But now we're talking about a game that's coming out on Kickstarter that's a card game that keeps score on a board. So there's that cardboard combo that we see a lot of, which is can be a very nice combination. How did we get from A to B? So if you can just, and obviously, don't tell me everything, but give me the shortcut of how you got where you are now from where you started. I mean, that's a hell of a journey.
It is. And it's a multi-year journey, and we won't go through obviously every day, but so it starts off, Bob comes into the game store. I'm hanging out, just playing games with my friends. I started with Magic the Gathering and other miniature games and Malifaux and all those games. And I'm playing, hanging out, and this guy comes up to me. Hey, I want you to paint some miniatures. They're for a game I'm working on. Oh, cool. I work on games too. What do you got? We started this conversation. He shows me this big idea. And it's just this overarching, like, '80s snowboard style movie idea about saving the, you know, snowboard club and getting $50 to bribe the bad guy to not tear it down, or, you know, concept wise. And, you know, we've joked about that a little bit.
That was the literal original concept.
That was the actual fun fact. And so he brings me this thing, and it's got like a board with different, you can go into buildings, and there's different panels for the buildings that have spaces in them, and you can do stuff, and you can, I won't go into crazy detail, obviously, but he shows me this thing, and I'm like, whew, okay.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. How does this work? And he shows me a rules set that is, and I'm going to not be offensive and say unpolished.
Sure.
It was a very first draft rule set, which every rule set when you are working on games starts at a point that is just unrecognizable.
Yep.
From there, I decided, I said, okay, it's very obviously important to, you know, Bob, to keep the characters. It's these characters' story. So how can I best tell this story in as concise a package as possible, trying to keep to the theme? And so, you know, the initial theme of just in my brain, I go, okay, let's cut away all the fluff and all the chaff. The basic idea is good guy versus bad guy, good guy versus bad guy. And then how do we build on that by taking away? And right. So the first thing we did was we took away the big board, and we said, okay, let's condense things down to like one little, I think we had like a 9x9 board at one point, like a 9 squares by 9 squares. And we're like, let's try just this and maybe like panels of these. And then we cut that down even further by going, okay, well, what if we just kept the characters and kept them to like one little scenario of what the big game would have been? And then we thought, well, okay, how can we make that one scenario interesting to play and
right.
make me invested in this scenario? And so then, you know, me and Bob had the conversation, and this was probably a year into it, by the way, when we had the conversation of, what if we just gave all these cool characters one really funny scenario to have to do? And that was, I think, when we started getting the idea of them doing, I think that might've been when we came up with the idea of them, they're standing in line. Okay. How can we make that interesting?
Yeah.
And so then it comes down to finding the mechanics that makes that theme work with the characters the most, structurally sound way possible. And I'm not saying the easiest way possible,
right?
Because the easiest way possible is you roll some dice and you're done. And that's all maximum variance, and nobody has fun except for people who like rolling dice. And
yep.
Nothing wrong if you
are playing Warhammer.
Yeah, Warhammer, Farkle. There's a billion games like them. But if you want a more controlled game, the game with the least variance that exists is chess.
Yes.
Where you know exactly how every piece moves, and there's nothing random that can happen. There's no surprises. It's just what is laid in front of you. And so finding that sweet spot between randomly flailing dice at a wall and between chess is, we kind of landed on, okay, let's take the dice out of and do cards. Let's do the hand size change 20 times.
I'm sure.
In testing, and the way the characters move changed, and then the way their abilities work changed a million times. And I would come to Bob and say, okay, well, here's what I'm trying right now. What do you think? And he would tell me, you know, oh, I like the way this works. I don't like the way this works.
Well, he's a great sounding board in that scenario, isn't he? Because he's not neck deep in it the way you were. So I'm curious, Bob, and this is going to sound like a silly question, but I think it's an interesting question for people listening. Like, how do you prototype and go through all these different ideas? So, you know, Michael's coming up with this idea. He's cutting that. He's adding this. He's boiling things down. In order for you to make any decision about that process and being a partner in this process, like, did you guys just keep creating, like, just print and play prototypes, and you play it out a few times to test it out? Like, what is that process like, Bob?
Well, that is my bread and butter, pretty much. That's the thing that I've been doing for years and years and years. And a lot of times the way that I work, and I know a lot of people will say you work like an idiot. But what I'll do is I'll actually come up with an idea in my head, and I'll just make it and I'll do it. And then I'll come to people and say, what do you think? For me, I've always kind of, I think, worked it a little backwards. Like, you know, I said I would start out with a big idea and then make changes from there. but I think it's, but I'm able to work quickly.
Sure.
And when you're doing the kind of rapid fire, like, and I'm talking about making, you know, the hand change 20 times, I'm not going to go to Bob with every single time I change one little aspect, because I'm lucky enough to have a very willing test pool of people who are willing to, you know, sit down and beta alpha test an idea.
That was going to be my next question, Michael, is, I mean, when you get a new idea, when you say to yourself, you know what, maybe instead of having 8 cards in the hand, it's better off at 5. You can either make that decision sitting there by yourself, or it sounds like you did have some soundboards to test that off of.
I can say one of my main tools that I used, other than the Lens of Bob, which was a very good tool for bringing things to the casual gamers level, is the fact that I had a very readily available group of testers. And testing is invaluable when you're making games. Well, you can't test enough.
Yeah.
And I would take and go, okay, well, I can't decide whether I want the hand to be 5 cards, 6 cards, or 7 cards. And so I would go to my little group of 3 or 4 people, and I would say, okay, I need you guys to do me a favor. Let's play 5 games, full games, of 5 cards per hand, 5 full games of 6 cards per hand, 5 cool games of 7 cards per hand, and just see how it works. And unlike when you're just sitting there shooting ideas off of each other, which is a good thing to do, when you're actually just sitting and playing it, we'd get halfway through, you know, game 2, and somebody'd be like, this sucks. And so we'd be like, okay, scrap that one. We're done with that idea. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And by done, I obviously mean shelved.
Sure.
Again, never throw away ideas. If people listening come away with one good piece of advice from me, it's don't ever throw away ideas. Just get them out of the game.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as a bad idea. It's just working to be applied.
Yep.
But yeah, it's the soundboard and the testers is really where I can say we did the most or was the most useful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to me too. So like, so how long do you put an idea through its paces, Michael? So you mentioned what you said, the card hands going up and down and things like that. You know, that sounds like a tweak and it's pretty immediate. So I'm going to rephrase this. What is the idea that lasted the longest that did not end up in the final product?
Ooh, that's a really interesting question. I would have to say the idea that lasted the longest that did not make it into the final product would probably be, I don't know, we had the dice in there for a long time. Dice was a key part of the game for quite a while until we finally just turned to cards. Once, other than dice, which was the game until we cut it, and right, then we just started with purely cards. Once we got to the card part, I would say that, oh my gosh, I'm sorry, I don't mean to stall this. There's just so many things that have gone in and out and in and out and in and out. I would probably say the ability to, and this was a very subtle thing that I ended up dropping in favor of putting into a different game more heavily that we're working on, the ability to remove cards from the game.
Interesting.
Probably, and it didn't get fully removed, but it did go way, way down from its initial. You know what I'm saying?
So, yeah, I do. So it was a part of the game for a good bit of time through lots of testings and a lot of changes. It had survived. Why did it finally get cut?
It finally got cut because I wanted to focus us more on the characters. And, you know, a lot of this cutting actually came on my end before I even showed stuff to Bob. Because we would talk about like game mechanics and stuff, like pure, like, how does this ability work, or how does this cards of hand work, or how does yada yada work? But I had, you know, what each card does, and that mechanic just, I didn't want to cut anybody ever. I didn't want to go, okay, well, Biff is no longer in the deck to be played with because right, Biff's an important character.
Yeah.
You know, even the bad guys, like, you know, the, I'm blanking, Oldie Moldy is one of the bad guys that I love. Polite old nun in a bathing suit. She's, you have to look at the card art for that one. She, I don't want to cut her from the deck, but at the same time, this mechanic is a mechanic that's cool to mitigate not being able to use those cards again. And so I ended up shelving it to be used in another project that we're working on, which we'll talk about later. But
gotcha.
That one was probably the longest lived.
Actually, you know what? Now that you mentioned Oldie Moldy, that could have actually also been one of the answers, because originally that card, that bad guy, was going to be an old nun in a bikini. No, an old nun in Spring Break. Yeah. And it was a lady wearing a habit and a black bathing suit, swinging her ruler. And that was in the game for a long time. And eventually we said, you know, maybe we should cut that. And we just turned her into an old lady in a bikini.
You took the Catholic aspect out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, let's generalize this a little bit.
Might be pushing it a little bit. So here's another question that I have for you. I'll give a little bit of a lead up to kind of give you context. So for several years throughout college, I was a bartender. That's how I paid for college. And I bartended a lot and learned two things. One, it was hard to be a good bartender, but it was something you could be proud of. So I was actually very proud of myself for being a good bartender. And it was harder than people think it was.
Oh, yeah. But I can imagine.
It was also not as hard as a lot of people think it was. So now that I haven't bartended in, you know, 20 years now, when I go to a bar, I have a great appreciation for a good bartender because I know how hard it is to be a good bartender. But I have no tolerance for bad bartenders because I know it's not that hard.
That's fair.
So I'd be curious, Michael and Bob, too, for you guys that have, you know, designed games and played in games, you know, like when you are a consumer of games, how critical are you? So I would imagine, obviously, the appreciation is the easy part, right? So when you see something, when you see a company or a designer doing something good, I would imagine your appreciation is higher than other people because you've made the sausage, you know, how hard it is to put out a good product. So when you see a good product, it's great. Do you find yourself being a little less tolerant of bad decisions and bad product?
Honestly, for me, everything that I do graphically, I try to do the best that I can. And, you know, graphic is my old bread and butter. And, you know, as a great photographer and editor, photography editor and designer, it's for me, it's always try to make it look as good as possible, make as many tweaks as you can. And if I see something that to me just looks like, you could have done better there. That is one of those things that just grates me. But another thing is also something that that is a peeve of mine, being as someone who isn't as, I guess, versed as things is looking at something that just doesn't immediately make me know I know what it's talking about. If I see something that I have to look at and say, I just don't get it, you know, to me, that's a turnoff. And
well, you come from a business of visual communication, right? Where it's communication, it's instantaneous based off of the visuals. That's literally what you do for a living. So I can imagine anything that creates any distance between the message and the visuals has got to be very frustrating because that's how you've made a living.
Yeah, I can look at something almost always and just say, oh, that right there, they should have done something different.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Yep. How about for you, Michael, though, as a game player, I'm very interested to know. I think you understand where I'm headed, right?
Oh, so I know exactly where you're headed.
Yeah. So like where you get madder than just a gamer would, we're more frustrated than just a gamer would because you know that a corner was cut or the testing was not as long as it should have been.
Having been in the industry as long as I have, which again, in the industry means I've worked on some games. I've sold a lot of games. I've been working in game stores, you know, since 2009. Now that I know how the sausage is made and I've seen behind the curtain enough, I have a very high appreciation, almost a like an obsession with finding the really good things.
Yeah.
And I'll find the things like, and I'm gonna dote on Malifaux for just a second. The theme is good, the mechanics are good, the balance is good. You know what I mean? There's nothing I can go, they half-assed this.
Right.
Like they did in Malifaux version 1 with Hamlin's rules, which I was vehemently would be angry about.
Yep.
That being said, you said would get a little, you know, a little bit of displeasure about certain things. I'm hypercritical of games now. It's to the point now where, and I do this and it irritates some of my friends, where I'll sit down with a game and I'll sit down to play them with the full intention of just enjoying a game and not trying to, but I can't help but go, this could have been done a lot better, and being vocal about it, because I have, you know, I'm a loud guy, I'm a talkative guy, and so I'll sit down with a game, and I'm gonna rag on a game for just a second. I hate Talisman. I can't stand.
You're not alone. I'm the same. I think you and I are alone though, because there's that game has a cult following, and I've played it 3 times, and I wish I hadn't played it those last 2 times, because I don't think it's a good game.
I've played Talisman plenty of times because I have several friends who that's all they have is like Talisman and Catan, which Catan's a fine game. I got no problem with
fine.
It. Catan's
fine. Yeah.
There's things I would do differently.
It's a good game, though.
It's a good game.
Yeah.
Talisman's such a piece of shit, and I'm going to get some angry messages about it, but like the things I'm seeing, and I'm not seeing things that I don't dislike it for the reason that, like, you and I probably dislike it for the same-ish reasons. You know, just the fact that it plays clunky, the turns take forever to do nothing. You know, you've got to wait for – you got 3 people playing. You're waiting 20 minutes to just doing this. You know, nothing. It's all variants. It's all dice rolls. And I'm sitting here looking at it going like, man, if there were only some way to just, you know – if only, why do we have an inventory system in this game? Why do I have to have a pack mule? Why can't I have things that modify the dice rolls in any way, shape, or form other than O+1? You know, stuff that's just lazy design got through with that game because we didn't know better when the game was created.
Well, that's exactly what I was about to say, Michael. It's an old game, right? I mean, it's an old game, and people that have listened to me for a while or heard me on other podcasts know that there's the old way of making games, and then there's what I call modern rule systems. And what I call modern changes over time, you know, things that were modern at the time, you know, aren't before. Like when Games Workshop put out the original Lord of the Rings game, that was a very modern rule system.
It was
that in a lot of ways took a lot of the indie ideas that were out there. And I hats off to the people that put together Lord of the Rings. They took a lot of indie ideas, they streamlined them, and they put together at the time what was a modern rule system. Now it's antiquated, right? Now it's antiquated. And, you know, you look at other games like God Tier, and you look at Malifaux and Guild Ball, and those are modern rule systems because they've changed over time. Talisman's just never changed.
Well, that right there is the reason that it makes me so mad, is because Talisman through Fantasy Flight Games got a rebuff. They re-released the game, and instead of taking a team of people and sitting down like Bob and myself and you and sitting down and going, okay, let's put a fresh new coat of paint on this. Let's take these mechanics that are antiquated and shitty and let's run them through the ringer and make them decent. Instead of, you know, doing anything like that, they were just like, nope. Free money. Let's just print it off and the cult following will chew it up because they're brainless. Instead, like, there's 1,000 better games that do it better. Every game that has Lovecraft on it nowadays, look at Kumani or Not's freaking stable of games. Look at our game. I would put my game up against Talisman right now and say, this is more fun to play.
Yeah, and I mean, the one thing I will give Talisman is it inspired. I mean, at the time, it was a groundbreaking game. At the time that it came out, it was a groundbreaking concept.
Yes,
and it gave birth to a lot of really neat games that took what was fun about Talisman, and that's a small thing now.
Yeah,
but said, you know, well, we can do this better. But Michael, what you said about Fantasy Flight Games was such a missed opportunity because, one, Fantasy Flight Games has already proven that they have access to phenomenal game designers because they have put out some good games.
Oh, they've put out some of my favorite games, but they've also canceled some of my favorite games.
Yeah, they've done that too.
I won't get into that.
So I agree. It was definitely a missed opportunity. So guys, we're going to take another quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to get a little bit deeper into really the journey from A to B a little bit more. So I want to step through it both from Michael's perspective and Bob's perspective, because really I think that they work together, but saw things from different sides. So we'll be right back.
Hi there, this is Owen from the Nova Open, and I am a $5 patron of Third Floor Wars because I love supporting the whole Malifaux community. I want to help Craig and the whole Third Floor Wars team continue making the fantastic content that gets me through my daily commute. You should join me in supporting the show. Just pause this episode, head to patreon.com and search Third Floor Wars, or grab the link in the show notes. See you there.
Want to do a quick shout out for our all-time top patrons, Nick Westbrook, Craig Chuba, Stephen Morris, Kevin Smith, Sam Newman, James Hahn, Jeremy Peace, Ambrose Ingram, and Corin Soles. It's because of you guys and gals that we're able to do what we do. So we talked a little bit about, you know, the design process, which again is something that I find really fascinating. But, you know, part of the reasons, and Bob, you're an artist and I'm a terrible artist, but art is something that I do as well. And, you know, you're never done, right? You can always make something a little bit better. You can always tweak this here, but at some point you have to stop. You have to stop painting the miniature. You have to stop working on the graphic. You have to stop painting the painting and just say, this is done. And I've got to start something else. So I'd be interested to know, how does that work in the context of game design? So at some point you have to say, you know what? We're sending this off. We're going to send this off. It's going to get made. It's going to get printed. And it doesn't mean we can't do things to it later. But what we've been doing for the past 6 months, what we've been doing for the past 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, right now we're saying this is a stopping point, and now we're going to send it off to the printers. I want to try to get an idea of how that decision gets made.
Well, basically what happened with me is I got sick of paying Michael every month and said, you know what? Let's just do it. I'm done. I've seen it already.
God, forget these guys.
Now, we graphic. Well, just so you know, I did not create the character art. What I did was I've learned a long time ago that even though I probably could do everything, I won't do everything great. So, you know, that's originally why I hired Michael. And I've brought in artists that do the work that, you know, that do character work, all the different characters. I've used, maybe six different artists so far. This one game has, one artist that did all the characters for the No Dice set. But we actually have a different artist that is drawing each of the other expansions. But I basically said, okay, I can't do that. For one thing, I can't draw nearly as well as they can. Mm-hmm. But when it came to everything else that I did, it was kind of like a, you know, I tried to get as many opinions as possible. You know, earlier I had said that I basically come up with a design that I like and then I try to tweak it. So for me, most of it was, does the copy and does the art look and feel good and done enough? Did I do everything that the printer needs? Did I format it correctly, you know, for what the manufacturers need? And I did a lot of that stuff while the game was still in the works.
Sure.
You know, Michael is still coming up with different ideas on how to do things, or maybe different character abilities that are going to be on the cards while I'm actually designing the box cover. So it's one of those things where it kind of goes back and forth, you know, throughout the whole process until we finally hit and say, okay, we're done here. And you know, he had said he has a lot of those play testers, and they go through and do a lot of the testing to make sure that it does work that way. When I play it, it's more of a, I either had fun or I don't get what just happened here. Why did this happen? And what if I had a question, I would, you know, I would either send a video to Michael or just ask him, okay, I don't get why this happened, or this kind of broke on me. How do we fix it?
That's an incredibly powerful perspective, just so you know, Bob, for Michael. I can tell you right now that having that perspective that you have is incredibly powerful. What I would like to know, though, is what for you, and we're going to talk about this with Michael in a second. Can you distill down for people listening? How did you put the pencil down? What was the pencil down moment for you?
God, you know, I don't know if it was more of a, okay, fine, I'm sick of looking at it type of a thing.
That's a factor.
And actually, that, you know, there probably was a lot of it, because if I'm not sick of looking at something, that means something I want to change.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, I got to the point where, okay, I don't see anything else that I really don't like. The game works well. Michael and his testers say it works well. I've had all my questions answered from other people. What do you think about how this looks? Where should this be? What about the colors and so forth? Once I had all of my questions answered and I thought, I just don't see anything else I want to fix, then... And the other thing is that I also have a very short attention span. So for me, typically, I would actually want to get something done sooner and I'm sick of it. But with this, it was a pet project of mine and I did concentrate harder and wanted to work more on it. But yeah, it was pretty much that, when no one else saw any other improvements and where I couldn't figure out what else to do. So, I think it's done.
How much for you, Michael? And I would imagine I want to talk about the ultimate pencils down moment, right? Where you just say, we're done. But I would imagine there's also points where you say things are now frozen. So, this part is done. I'm not going to revisit it again. I'm not going to touch it because we've messed with it for long enough. So can you walk me through, maybe let's work backwards. How do you get to that final, all right, I'm not going to mess with it anymore. This thing is going to get printed and we're done. Like what causes that moment to happen?
The main thing for me, at least to get to that point, is to make sure that fundamentally looking through all the rules that I've written and looking through all the rules that Bob has written and seeing the pure mechanics. And this is all on paper. My final judgment is not based on the gameplay. Okay. Like I don't play one last game and go, that's it. This is the version I like. I know how the game plays. I've played it a billion times. My last read through of the rules is to go, okay, I don't hate this because I can always make me like it more later.
Right.
I can always, for an expansion, do an idea I wanted to do here. And it's all purely ideas. It's not balance issues. Those can be redacted. Those can be changed in erratas. Those can be, tweaked in further expansions and stuff. It's purely going, I've got the game balanced correctly now. I've got the rule set that I like. I don't hate this. Done with it. And I actually, for this particular game, I had one very final pins down moment when I was like, I think we're just done here. In the sense that I going back to testers, I have a very, I highly value people who will test my game honestly.
Yep.
And so I surround myself with people who have certain viewpoints. I have one friend who's a huge fan of card games and nothing else. Mm-hmm. He can't stand board games. If it has dice, he hates it.
Yep.
Like, that's just not his style. I have a friend of mine who loves Talisman. I have a friend of mine who is really into video games and just doesn't understand the point of owning a physical game. Mm-hmm. And I value each of their opinions. And once I have a game, like for this board game, for instance, I know I'm tangenting just a touch, but for this game, for instance, we wanted to make it for the more casual gamer, not the crazy rules obsessed guy like myself, or not someone who's video game prone, or not the hyper competitive. We wanted this for, a couple people having fun for a day. So when one of my friends who's got a family who all played it, and they were like, "Yeah, I've had a great time with it. We played a game before dinner, and here's your copy back. Thanks for letting us play." I value that very highly. Yeah. My pins down moment, though, was when my friend who hates board games played it, and he handed it back to me. He goes, "This sucks."
So maybe he hated it. You had the right thing.
Well, I knew, because I know the games he likes, and right. I wasn't making a game for him. I was making. Right. He goes, "It works. I hate it, but it works." And I'm like,
perfect. "That's interesting, Mike." So what didn't he like about the game that told you you might be in the right spot?
He likes a game that's specific to this one person. I'm not going to call him out on it.
Yeah, that's fine.
He likes a game that he can find some way to abuse. He's a big Magic the Gathering player, big in Warhammer 40K. He likes to be able to go, "I can do this one thing and you can't stop me."
Right. I can break it.
When he can break it, he loves to mess with rule sets like that. And so when I show him a project or I run a rule set by him and he goes, I'm not a fan. I know that I've hit something that he can't intrinsically automatically win at.
Balance.
Yeah.
That's
and so
funny.
I was gratified, and he'd be like, "Well, it sucks." And he's gonna know who he is if he listens to the podcast. And he's gonna send me a message being like, "Well, it did."
That's funny. But that's a good barometer. I mean, you know, there's people that I know from a gaming perspective that are very good at finding the hole. Oh, they're very good at finding the shortcut. And I think that if you are a game designer, it's got to be very valuable to have the person who comes at games from that direction. Because he's going to expose the holes that are there. Go ahead.
Well, that's something that I do want to touch on that you're mentioning here is having the person with that perspective. I think it's vitally important, and this is, again, one of my big design concepts, to have reviewers who I know are consistent in their reviews and, like, testers who are consistent in the way they do things. I know my friend hates board games, and he will only play them because I asked him to politely. And so if he comes to me and he goes, you know, this actually wasn't that bad. I go, okay, what video game is it like? And I go, I didn't want him to, not that I didn't want him to like this. I know if it's in his wheelhouse, right, it's probably more competitive than I want it to be.
It's informative. His opinion becomes informative to you from a design perspective.
Right. Which is why I don't, unlike Bob, and this is something that we've not come to, you know, disagreements about much, but I don't, this is going to sound really douchey, I don't value the court of public opinion that highly. I don't make the posts on Facebook that says, hey, what does everybody think of my game? Because I'm going to have one guy love it, one guy hate it, one guy want to buy it, one guy want to sell it. And if you go, what do you like, red or blue? 50 are going to say red, 50 are going to say blue, all for
different
reasons.
Game design can't be a democracy.
It cannot be a democracy. Yeah. It has to be. But there is value in going, okay, I know the kind of games this one person likes.
Yep.
This guy likes highly competitive, highly skill-based games. This other person is a very simple gamer, and they like very simple games and don't like complicated stuff. If he likes this game and he doesn't like this game, then I know where on my barometer that game falls.
Yep.
So I know consistency in the people that I'm getting, because you can pay $20, you know, for some YouTuber to give you a yes man video, which is, some of them are valuable. Like, we've got several videos of people reviewing the game who honestly reviewed it and gave us critique, and they did like it, which is awesome. But I don't want to, you know, pay $50 for a guy to go, like, this game's great and I highly endorse it .com, buy my merch. I don't care about that opinion at all.
Well, and having that stable at your disposal, Michael, has got to be incredibly valuable. And I thought probably the most interesting thing that I pulled out of what you said there was that consistency, where you have a stable of people that are kind enough to help you out in this process, and you know what person A, person B, person C, you know their lanes, and you know going into it where you'd like the game to fall in each one of those lanes, and getting the feedback from them, from their ability to be consistent reviewers to you, and consistent feedback is huge. So guys, we're going to take one more break. When we get back from this break, I want to talk about really kind of the next step. So we've talked about how we get started, where it begins, the process to get to when we finally send it off to the printers. Now I want to talk a little bit more about the business side of it. So we're going to talk about bringing the game to market. So we'll be right back. Howdy friends, here on the third floor, you'll find us playing Malifaux and other games on Mats by Mars. They are scratch resistant, waterproof, wet erase marker compatible, and lighter than neoprene. Mats by Mars gives you over 40 designs to choose from. Pick a mat size, pick a design, then choose an overlay like the one for Marvel Crisis Protocol or Malifaux 3rd Edition. It will speed up deployment and the placement of strategy and objective markers. If you're going to Adepticon this year, be sure to check out the Mats by Mars booth. Until the end of March 2020, you can use the new promo code THIRDFLOOR320, that's THIRDFLOOR320, to get a 10% discount on your next order. In the notes, you can ask for the Third Floor logo to be put on your mat for free. Again, use the promo code THIRDFLOOR320 to get a 10% discount. Details are in the show notes. So far we've talked about really the fun stuff, and not to be flippant about it, but quite frankly, A lot of us have sat down and we have created games and we've printed them up on our printer and we've played them with friends. And a lot of times we can think, you know, when we, you know, are talking about Malifaux, that we say, boy, this is garbage and they could have done this so much better. It's a whole lot different to go through the process that Bob and Michael has done, which is a concept which a million people have, to actually putting in the hard work of making the hard decisions to go through the design and testing process, which a much smaller subset have, but a lot have done that as well. But what Bob and Michael now have done is they have produced a game, and they they've put it out on Kickstarter. So Bob, I want to kind of understand that last leg of the journey. If somebody listening has never done this last step, can you talk about some of the things that you learned in that process, some of the pitfalls they should watch out for, some things that you actually liked about the process that you didn't even anticipate?
Yeah, sure. It's I have to say that I probably have a little unfair advantage that a lot of other people probably don't have, because for 20 years or so, I actually was also in the advertising and print industry. So I know how to put files together that need to go to a printer. I know how to, you know, what kind of requirements they need. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, what you look on a computer is 72 dots per inch, meaning little pixels per inch, whereas a printer needs at least 300. Well, okay, the biggest problem actually was the fact that, unfortunately, most games cannot be produced in the United States.
Yep.
Because sadly, costs are just way too high. And, you know, this game is going to be $25. If we wanted to produce it in the United States, we would have to sell it for probably $40.
Yep.
And it just, that really stinks. But because of that, you know, we had to get it produced overseas and trying to figure out the language barriers, or just the social barriers too, you know, just communicating with them. When I said, okay, tell me exactly what you need. This guy was just basically saying, I need you to send me the files. Okay, well, in what format? I don't know if they do, you know, certain kind of formats. I don't know what they need. I was basically expected to draw out my whole, like the box. I had to come up with the box design. I had to design where the folds were going to go, how far over the inks had to go on the page, because, you know,
some bleeds
people,
and everything.
Yeah,
huh?
The bleeds. And, you know, I was expecting to go into this pure, you know, 100% handheld. I was thinking it's a game company. They know what they're doing. They're going to send
me
templates.
Here's the requirements. You fill them.
Yeah. Yep. But, you know, our game, I guess it probably didn't. It's approximately a 9x6 box, but I don't know if they probably can't have a template for every single size that's out there. So a lot of it was me having to figure out how to do all these things. And I had to go back and forth and back and forth. And with us being in separate, you know, 12 hours apart. And that was a real big issue.
How did you figure out who to work with?
How
did you know who to go to?
A lot of it was going through, asking on different groups, you know, what are some printers that you've worked with? But a lot of people, you know, when you go onto Facebook or any other kind of a group, you're going to get billions of opinions. And some person may have a horrible experience with somebody, the next person may have, you know, saying they were the best one ever. So, yeah, it kind of had to take that stuff with a grain of salt. One big thing was to send over your specific requirements and get your quotes. To figure out who was going to come in price-wise. Now, a lot of these companies actually did come very close in prices, which surprised me. There were a couple of them that were way out there, but most of them were pretty close to each other. So then you can kind of say, all right, well, let's get that one out. You'd have them then send paper samples and see what kind of stuff they do. Fortunately for me, I had actually become a member of the Indie Game Alliance, which is an organization that tries to help people as much as they can, try to find printers, try to find playtesters, try to find all these different things.
That's great.
By doing that, they referred me to this company, and they even, because I was a member of the Game Alliance, I was able to get a discount on the pricing.
Nice.
And I took his advice and I went with these guys. And when we actually came back with the finished product, first thing I did was I brought it over to Michael and you know, I said, you know, I want your opinion. Is this good quality stuff? You've played a lot more card games than I have. And he said, this is fantastic. You know, he showed me the whole bending trick to make sure it was good paper, if it doesn't crease and so forth. And everyone that I've shown has said, wow, this is really good quality stuff. So I was really happy with how it turned out. You know, some of the communications, they do kind of, it lacks a little bit, but I think a lot of it is because I think I've had the same issue with almost every country or with every company that I've dealt with. It's been the same sort of, I don't know how to deal with you because you're from another country than me.
So something that's become a little bit commonplace and a common bitch thread on whatever forums or Facebook you see is production delays, right? So every Kickstarter is going to be, you know, is delayed 3 months and 4 months. And you get the note from the creators that say, you know, this is taking longer than it should have. You know, we anticipated this and this has become a roadblock and we're working our way through it. Do you have a level of appreciation for how hard that process is and, you know, how easy it is to underestimate how long it'll take to get from point A to point B?
Oh, exactly. Now, you're talking about before COVID-19 happened, right? You're just talking about...
Yeah. Let's not even get into the fact that we're all under quarantine now, but...
Well, yeah. When I first heard that it was going to take 45 days, you know, they told me that it was going to take 45 days, and I was thinking, well, you know, I just got these cards back from another company. They sent me three demo sets of cards, for, you know, 2 days later. Well, you have to realize that these guys are printing a minimum of 1,500 copies, and it's not just a deck of cards. You know, they actually take this deck of cards, they then put it into a folded tuck box, and to print the folded tuck box, you have to print it, cut it out, fold it, you know, assemble it, stick the cards into it. Then they take that and they put it into a box with a bunch of other stuff. Yep. So there really is a lot of assembly required and a minimum of 1,500 of these things. Plus, I'm only one of however many other products they're trying to do that during the day.
Sure.
And they really did. That was a big issue, but it's something that it's understandable. The other thing was then you have shipping. You have two choices. Basically, you can stick it on a big cargo ship and you wait another 45 days for it to ship. And then it has to go through customs, which sometimes may or may not be delayed. Fortunately, mine wasn't. And then you have the truck that takes it from the port down to where you're going. So there's a lot of these different things. Now, the other thing is I did have prototypes done by them. And, you know, before I said I'm going to go ahead and pull the trigger on the 1,500 copies, I said, let's go ahead and just send a prototype, or they sent me five prototypes. They sent me the boxes with, you know, exactly how it looks, because I wanted to send it to reviewers. And that one, they were able to not overnight it, but get it to me five copies within a week. They were able to print these together. Yeah. And problem was, though, I had to pay like $500 to get those five copies.
Right.
You know, normally you're only paying, like, let's say $5 a copy for your game, or sometimes a little more, a little less. But yeah, I had to pay $100 a copy.
Yeah, which are on sale right now for $200 a piece.
So my last question on this before we kind of wrap up, Bob, is what led you to decide there's several different ways to put out a game. What made you decide, A, you were going to self-publish, and B, you were going to use Kickstarter?
We actually kind of went back and forth between Kickstarter. What can we do to get these into people's hands to realize that this really is actually a good game with a lot of humor and a lot of strategy, a very good game. I decided, you know, this is something that I've been doing for 25 years now. I'm just going to go ahead and self-publish it. I'm going to take some money out that I had, and I said, I'm going to use my own money and just make it and just do it. And then that way, people really didn't have to say, well, I don't want to pledge on Kickstarter for something that may come in 6 months later. Because, you know, most games, you know, people just give you an idea, then they still have to get the artist. They have to get finish the rules, everything. And I said, I wanted to have a game that I can just say, listen, you are going to like it. We're making it affordable and it's available now. As soon as the Kickstarter is done, you can get it. Let's make a low goal, a 2-week pledge on Kickstarter, and make it something so that people will just want to get that they can actually still play and receive while they're at home quarantining.
Sure.
So we added those four extra cards that people can get. We're getting those cards done locally. I know when these are done, they're as soon as the Kickstarter is done, if it funds, when it funds, these cards are going to be done within the week because I know who's doing them. They're going to be in my hands. This game is going to be shipped out ASAP.
Well, I got to tell you, I can't remember, Michael, how I came across all of this at first. I think it's you put it on. You and I are friends on Facebook, and I think it's where I first came across it. One of the first things that I noticed was the turnaround from the closing of the Kickstarter to the, you know, the promised delivery. And boy, does that make it attractive. The price point makes it attractive. I think a lot of people listening are going to find the mechanics and theme of this pretty attractive. So let's get into a little bit of salesman mode, Bob. First of all, when is the Kickstarter? We're right now, it's April 18th when we're recording. When does the Kickstarter open?
On April 21st, in just 4 days or okay. 3 days from now. I hope you're going to have this done by then.
We will. So, and for those listening, if they are going to get their hands on this and pledge, when does the Kickstarter close?
It is a 14-day campaign, so 14 days after the 21st, whatever that is. It's going over a month, and I don't know how many.
It's probably good that you know what this date is, Bob, so why don't you look it up real quick?
That's going to be May 5th.
May 5th, okay. So the Kickstarter itself closes on May 5th, and then you're looking to deliver within 2 weeks of the 5th? Is that what I understand?
Yeah, the game is already in our warehouse. Like I said, we've already published it. We've already manufactured it. It is sitting in the warehouse. In the United States, in Georgia. So when the thing closes and we're able to get our pledges in, it's all right, let's start shipping them out. And people
so theoretically, I might have, because I'm buying the game, so I might have that in my hands by early June at the latest, maybe? Cross our fingers?
At the latest.
Oh, at the very latest, yeah.
Oh, that's exciting. Let's talk about the future a little bit. Let's go beyond this. So you guys talked about shelving some ideas, working on some other games. Can we talk about two or three more minutes about what people can look forward to from you guys?
Well, actually, Michael already knows what our next game is going to be. I'm a guy that owns, I have 15 parrots. Most of my parrots have been rescues. And I thought, I want to do a game that's very simple that kids and grandmothers can play with each other. And I came in with a game called Parrot Parrot, which is basically where you pair parrots together. Okay. And the original theme was to build a flock. Michael actually came up with an idea to make it even more simple.
So I actually have the deck in front of me of our prototype for this game. So Parrot Parrot is a game that we're the next game we're going to put out. It's a dexterity-based game, all about matching pairs of parrots that you pair on your board by flipping pairs of parrots and letting them touch each other on the board. So you take and flip a parrot card from your hand, just flip it onto the board. If it touches its same a member of its flock, which you can tell by symbols and such, then you get to collect them and get points.
Yeah, okay. He's actually trying to demonstrate this like he's on video, but basically, you'll have several parrots down face up on the table, and you have a hand. It's sort of like Old Maid, except instead of just saying here, there's a match, I'm just going to take it and put it down. You actually have to take one of the parrots in your hand and flip it and let it fly down and touch one of the other parrots.
So it's a little bit of trick taking card mechanic combined with dexterity.
Yeah,
or more like Old Maid is why I say.
Yeah.
It's very, very simple. You see two macaws, you flip them, you touch them. But we also have another one that's going to come out right after that one or maybe at the same time. It's called The Race to Stuff Your Face. And we kind of took the same characters from the Unperfect Heroes Battle Lines game. And it's something where you basically, again, it's another – what we're trying to do is since we're in this – quarantining and the economies, we're trying to come out with games that are going to be very affordable. These next two games are going to be Unperfect Heroes is $25, but Parrot Parrot and Racist If Your Face, those are going to be somewhere around $15 each.
Wow.
So they're going to be very affordable for people, but fun.
Yeah.
And that's what we're really trying to do right now. We're putting the larger games on hold, getting things out that are be very affordable and fun for people that they can play sooner than later. Yeah. And what exciting. I've also done with these other games is I've already started most of the artwork. We have most of the artwork already done. So as soon as we're able to go ahead and get that Kickstarter done, it's probably going to go to production within the month.
Great. So, guys, I'm going to have a link to the Kickstarter in my show notes. I'll also have a link to your guys' website as well, so that people can check you guys out. I do appreciate it. I find it very valuable to learn what happens on the other side of what I consume. I am often a critic. I am not short on opinions, and I have learned through the process of talking to people that actually are producing the stuff that I'm consuming that some things aren't as easy as you think. And there's a lot of work that goes into it. So I appreciate you guys sharing that. Bob, any last things that you want to make sure everybody understands?
No.
Okay, good. How about you, Michael?
No, just a word of encouragement for people who are making games. Do it. Make your game. I wrote a big, long Facebook post about this in one of the game groups. If you've got an idea for a game that you love, build it, flesh it out, make it, test it, get a demo copy of it, and realize that it's going to suck. And then from there, you can start actually creating games. You know what I mean? Because, like, as we talked about this whole, you know, couple of hours now, you know, it's a process. And you've got to start – you've got to pull the Band-Aid off of thinking that you're going to have the perfect thing on version one, which you're not.
And Michael, that's really good advice. And people reach out to me all the time about starting a podcast or starting a YouTube channel. And the first thing I tell them is I say, buy a camera and buy a mic. Just start recording stuff.
The version and the first episode sucks of everything.
It's going to be terrible. But you can read everything you want. You can study everything you want.
Yeah.
You're not going to get better by doing that. The only way you're going to improve is to start doing it.
Absolutely,
so I think that's
correct.
Really good advice.
Yeah, I did actually think of something I did want to say is, if you are trying to create a game, you know, as Michael said, do it. Try to do it. But what I would really strongly advise everybody is don't always assume that you know that your game is great. Don't be your own marketplace. Make sure that you try to test with other people, both people that you know will like it and people that you don't necessarily know will like it. And try to not do everything yourself. Try to find people that you can work with that understand your vision and that you can actually get along with. And because when you collaborate, you really are going to bounce things off each other and it's going to make things so much better.
Bob, I think that's good advice to say, you know what, at some point, Bob, you're an artist, right? But you were smart enough, in my opinion, to be able to say, you know what, there's other people that are better than me and I can give them currency and they will produce something better than I would. My time is valuable and they probably can even produce something better faster than I could. And there's a lot of value in that.
And that gives me a lot of time to work on the other things that I know that I am good at.
Well, yeah. And not to mention the fact that you got 75 parrots in your house. So that's got to take up some time too, right?
A lot of parrots.
Yeah. All right, guys. So thanks to both of you. And for those of you that stuck around to the end, thanks for listening. Take care. Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest gaming apparel and gear. While you're there, check out how the USFO Tour is shaping up. How does your conference compare to the others in the United States? Where do you rank nationally? Get those models built, painted, and on the table so we can see you at the US Masters Invitational in October of 2020. Also, rate and write a review on this podcast for us. It really helps us find people almost as cool as you are. Thanks for listening. Howdy, friend. Craig here. Is this episode making you realize you need to buy some models? Gadzooks Gaming is my favorite online retailer because of their large selection, killer prices, and great customer service. Don't you hate buying an entire crew box when you only need one model? Gadzooks sells crew box models individually and saves you a ton of money. They even have free shipping to the US and Canada if you spend $100 or more. Swing by GadzooksGaming.com and make sure you tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. All the details are in the show notes. Howdy, folks. Craig here. Now, if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with two measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring, along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast.
That's the hard part.
Yes. Yeah, everything else we talk about is some easy shit, right?
Yeah, this is leaning more towards Bob's side now.
That's good, because I'm kind of tired of hearing you, Michael. So
I don't blame you.
Yeah, sure. Well, hold on. My son is coming down the stairs like a rhinoceros. Okay, shush. Close the door. He's a loud kid. Well, basically, what happened with me is I got sick of paying Michael every month.
All right, you know what? I've got the idea. I'm going to talk about when you decide it's time to send stuff to the printers. So I'll set up the segment and we'll go from there. That'll be interesting. All right. This next segment will be short because we ended up covering a lot of this.
What is in your drink? I'm trying to figure out what those little floating things are.
That is hopefully ice.
I didn't know what you asked me. I'm sorry.
In your drink, you have little floaty
things? Oh, it's pickled peppers. This is a martini.
Oh. I was so like, it's either really dirty ice or it's...
No, it's little pickled peppers. Huh? It's kind of like an olive, but it's a pepper instead.
Yeah, that's just nuts. I don't drink, and I can't see why most of the people drink what they do drink, because that sounds gross.
Yeah, I don't drink that much either.
It's just, it's like a spicy olive.
Yeah, by the way, I didn't mean to just shit on Talisman. I just...
Oh, no, dude. You and I are smoking the same grass on that one. Oh, don't worry.
God. Someone's going to angrily message me about it. It's a classic. You're not supposed to shit on those.
Maybe I should chime in and say, I like Talisman. You know, Bob, all I know about Talisman is what Michael's told me. That's all I know about that game.
My only problem with it is that they had a chance to redo it. If Talisman had only come out once...
That was a good call.
Yeah. Then I'd be like, okay, it was an old game. It sucks, but it's old. It did its thing.
Well, and you know who did a good job of this was when they put out the new version of Dune. Mm-hmm. They made just a couple little changes to Dune is just a great freaking game.
Oh, yeah.
And they made just a couple slight little touches, and it kept it Dune, and they patched a few holes, and that's exactly what Fantasy Flight could have done.
They could have done it with that. They could have done it with Netrunner, which I'm still salty about and will be salty about forever.
Dude, I've owned that game, and I've had so many people tell me what a great game it is, and I can't make it through the goddamn rule book.
I think that's a testament to the fact that I think that's a testament to how deeply jaded I am when it comes to rules, is because I look at the rule set for Netrunner, which is just convoluted. It's like reading the Silmarillion. Like, you want to love it, but it's so wordy and garbage.
Yeah.
But for me, I'm just like, I love every bit of that rule. Like, I soak it up. I'm like, give it to me.
I mean, I've been told that it's one of the best card games that's ever been made. But, you know, and part of that is I haven't found anybody to play with. But my process is I don't want someone to teach me a game. I want to learn the game and then play the game, not coming in knowing nothing. I am not a good student if I come in completely ignorant.
I respect that. Yeah,
and so that creates a barrier.
Is not right for you.
Yeah, it creates a barrier. Yep. All right, guys, for this segment here, I want to get more into kind of behind the curtains, and obviously we'll still be talking about the game. But right. I want people to get a little bit insight into that process of what it is to design it. So, Michael, if it's all right, I'm going to start with you, and I want to talk about and focus on how did you go from I want to make yet another 150 miniature RPG dungeon crawl to we're gonna essentially make a card game that keeps score on a board. And I want to kind of understand from a design perspective how you got there based on what was initially presented to you. Does that make sense?
It does. let's I guess just start at the beginning, and I won't, you know.
Let me start the segment first.
Yeah, we haven't started that.
I'm sorry, I thought we started.
Actually, a quick question.
That sounded so official. I apologize.
Yeah, that's tough. That's tough. So, where I lost my spot. Shit. Ah, good job, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
It's
we're trying.
Intermission time. Time to grab a snack.
All right. So next segment. Bob, based on our conversation, I'm probably going to start with Mike on this, but please, you've done a good job chiming in when you did. And part of the reason I like having the webcams on is it allows me to get visual cues to know when you've got something to say. So it's good. You handled that perfectly.
Yeah, good. Very good.
Yes, very good.